From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
One of the most extreme acts of barbarism in the annals of American law enforcement.
We go to Northern California to hear about the pepper spray torture case where police repeatedly applied the burning chemical directly to the eyeballs of young anti-logging protesters. Then a look at referenda around the country with a focus on Houston's anti-affirmative action ballot initiative. And off to the races, we look at the nation's only two gubernatorial contests in Virginia and New Jersey. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations decided yesterday to send a three-man delegation to Iraq after President Saddam Hussein again defied the world body by refusing entry to three American arms inspectors and warning that continued U.S. U-2 reconnaissance flights could be fired on by Iraqi anti-aircraft guns. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said last night the team will leave for Baghdad today. UN sources said the decision to send a high-level diplomatic mission to Iraq came after the United States dropped its objections to the move. The sources said the United States went along on the understanding that the team's mandate will be to remind Saddam of his obligation to comply with council resolutions and not make any concessions or negotiate in any way. The sentiment among UN members is to seek a diplomatic resolution of Saddam's latest attempt to challenge the Security Council and break free of the stringent economic sanctions it's imposed on Iraq. But senior Clinton administration officials have refused to rule out a resort to military force if necessary. And yesterday, top congressional leaders, among them Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, Republican from Mississippi, and House Speaker Newt Gingrich, Republican of Georgia, said the United States must respond to Iraq in whatever manner is required. In his final U.S. tour finale, Chinese President Jiang Zemin said the two countries will grow closer as China embraces Hong Kong and attempts to settle disputes with Taiwan. He was speaking in California yesterday. His remarks appeared intended to present a picture of a forward-looking China and to diminish the impact of the protesters who trailed him everywhere to criticize Chinese policy on Tibet, Taiwan, and human rights. He is scheduled to leave for China today. Jiang had dinner last night with California Governor Pete Wilson, who criticized New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and Governor George Pataki for refusing to meet Jiang while he was in New York. The mayor and the governor said they were protesting China's human rights record. A growing number of scientists warn that at the rate political leaders are going, it may be impossible to avoid a dangerous doubling of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. Mainstream climatologists say a doubling of pre-industrial levels would raise temperatures from 3 degrees to a potentially catastrophic 8 degrees, disrupting the Earth's climate and causing the seas to rise. The makers of items that carry the Duke University logos will soon be required to sign a pledge they won't use sweatshop labor. The code of conduct being worked on by Duke and Collegiate Licensing Company, which negotiates trademark deals for 160 universities, will require companies to fully disclose working conditions in their factories. At the urging of student leaders, Duke is one of a handful of schools, including Notre Dame, revising their contracts to include a code of conduct for manufacturers. On Friday, students at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, met with former basketball coach Dean Smith about alleged working conditions in Nike's overseas factory. Nike has contracts with both Smith and the Duke basketball coach. He's 14 years old. He'll soon become the youngest person sent to an Ohio prison, and he says he'll kill himself if he gets the maximum sentence. Donzel Lewis pleaded guilty last month to involuntary manslaughter and the shooting death of a teenage mother. He also pled guilty to charges stemming from two violent armed robberies. The teen has told his mother in a letter he'll kill himself if he receives the maximum sentence of 46 years in an adult prison when he's sentenced next month. A juvenile crime expert argues it's inhumane to give adult punishment to someone in his early teens, regardless of the crime. Amtrak and its track maintenance workers have reached a settlement that has lifted the threat of a national strike. Hundreds of thousands of people who use the service and the commuter rails would have been affected. Amtrak is now awaiting congressional rescue package, which has been held up over partisan bickering. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott wants to roll back labor protections in an effort to make Amtrak more cost-effective, he says. Democrats oppose Lott's conditions for Amtrak receiving aid. They regard his provisions as anti-labor. The tentative tentative agreement between the union and Amtrak gives workers a wage increase each year, but will amount to less than the annual 3% proposed by mediators. The contract still requires ratification. The number of minorities entering U.S. medical schools dropped this year, most drastically in states affected by affirmative action rollbacks. The Association of American Medical Colleges released a study Saturday of the nation's 125 accredited medical schools that showed an 11% drop in African Americans, American Indians, Mexican Americans, Chicanos, and Puerto Ricans applying to medical schools. In addition, 6.8% fewer of those minority students were accepted for 1997 than in 1996. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The videotapes are shocking. They show Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies in California methodically pepper spraying into the eyes of nonviolent protesters, and they now are demands of a full investigation by California Attorney General Dan Lundgren. The tapes were made public on Thursday, and the sounds have become familiar. The tapes are actually made by the police, and the tapes were made public by nine anti-logging activists from Headquarters Forest Defense who filed a federal lawsuit against the Sheriff's Department and the Eureka Police Department, saying their civil rights were violated by the sadistic use of pepper spray. Again, what the sheriff's deputies did is apply liquid pepper spray with cotton swabs directly to the protesters' eyes or held them in headlocks while spraying them in the face at close range. We're joined right now by one of the young protesters who participated in one of the protests over the last few months where the sheriff's deputies moved in. She's Spring Lundberg. She's 17 years old, a high school student, and she was attacked in Eureka, California, in the office of California Congressmember Frank Riggs. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Spring.
Hi, thanks, Amy.
Can you tell us about the day that you held your protest, why you held it, and what happened?
Well, actually, I wasn't at the Riggs office protest. I was at the first incident in Scotia, California, at the Pacific Lumber headquarters.
And when was that?
That was September 25th of
and
this year.
And why were you there?
Well, that day marked the day that Charles Hurwitz came to trial for the $1 billion that he owes the taxpayers. Charles is from Houston, a corporate raider, and he and his company, Maxam, own Headwaters Forest, which is up here in Humboldt County, and we're calling for the preservation of the ancient trees up here. And so we went to the headquarters office of Pacific Lumber and had a sit-in there on that day.
Who held the sit-in?
Well, it was seven of us, me and six other activists. There was also a rally and skit outside with endangered species and Charles on trial with a redwood tree judge.
And what did you do inside?
We were singing songs and holding hands, and we had black bears, which are V-shaped metal boxes, metal sleeves you can put your arms into, and using chain bracelets clip to a pin inside, and that way hold hands inside the boxes and stay linked together.
And are you able then to shed those or not?
Yes, you have the power to clip or unclip from these boxes. Mm-hmm. And that day, the Humboldt County Sheriff arrived, and soon after arriving, announced that they were going to use chemical weapons.
What do you mean?
Well, they gave the warning that in 5 minutes they would be using pepper spray, and one of the women had asthma. I remember telling the sheriff, do you know that people have died from this? Asthma and people who have heart conditions are very severely affected. They didn't care. The woman who had asthma was a public school teacher, and she said that to the officers. And one officer said, well, you're going to get an education, lady.
And so what exactly did the sheriff's deputies do?
Well, we're totally nonviolent movement up here. We curled into ourselves. I went into the fetal position, ducking my head. I thought that they were going to spray the air or something. I didn't know. This has never happened to me before. And then I felt the sheriff come towards me, and many hands grabbed my head and hold it back as they applied this burning liquid to my face. So felt like molten fire.
Where do they apply it on your face?
They spread the eye area back, and they applied it to the crease of the eye and the tear duct and underneath. And immediately the pain set in, and it was really bad. And the worst thing was it increased in intensity over a short period of time. I felt like I was going to scratch my face off. I didn't know what to do. And as I started to lay down on the floor, they grabbed me again and did it again. And meanwhile, you know, people were crying all around me. I couldn't see. I was blinded by this, yet I could hear my friends around me in a lot of pain. Right before they did this, three of the people unlocked, one of them who had asthma, so that we weren't a circle anymore. It was just me and this woman holding hands together and then two others. Yet they refused to rethink their decision and carry us out. They were very brutal, and I went through a lot of pain as they were jeering comments about pepper spray being effective and the videotape was rolling. They had, working with Pacific Lumber Security, they had covered the windows so that people outside couldn't see. And, I don't know, it was the most scary experience.
Wow. So this was the first time this was done?
Yes, it was somewhat of a case study. They were using us as lab specimens to see if this kind of brutality and use of force would be effective in the future against people like me who are nonviolent and who want to speak out about the destruction of the ecosystem and the working community up here. They ended up carrying us out anyway. So
after they did this and after you were writhing around for a while,
yes.
Then they just carried you out?
Yes.
And arrested you?
Yes, I was taken to juvenile hall, where the juvenile hall department was very shocked. I heard people in the background as I was calling my father saying, "Is that legal what they did to her?"
What were you charged with?
No
screaming?
Charges. No charges.
No charges.
Mm-mm.
So they just brought you to juvenile hall and then
right.
Let you go home?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In addition to Spring Lundberg, who was one of the participants in the protest, the first of the protests that where they used the pepper spray, applying it directly to the eyes of the protesters, were joined by Mark Harris, who's an attorney representing the 9 demonstrators protesting Pacific Lumber's plans to log old-growth forests. Mark Harris, can you tell us what are the grounds of the lawsuit?
Amy, the lawsuit is a civil rights lawsuit. This is a lawsuit that is claiming that what the sheriff's deputies and the Eureka Police Department did to these women, and it primarily is women, violated their rights against excessive force to be free of the kind of totally intrusive and brutal force that was applied to them. Under the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment, people in America have the right to expect only that amount of force, if any, that is appropriate to a given situation. In this situation, you had a lot of very young people, as young as 16 years old, in fact, sitting peacefully around in circles, holding hands through metal sleeves, and singing. And you had, it's very clear on both the police videotapes that we have so far, that the very first thing that law enforcement did when they got there was to immediately threaten the use of chemical agents, this horrific chemical weapon, pepper spray, and then to carry through on that threat without regard to any type of alternative force that a reasonable law enforcement officer might have used. And so the lawsuit, certainly the first thing we're seeking right now is an injunction to stop this, because as amazing as the videotapes that have been released are so far, the Sheriff's Department and the Eureka Police Department have refused to agree to even temporarily suspend this policy so that we can have a hearing on this.
Now, there have been 3 protests since the one that Spring engaged in, or 2 protests in addition, where the pepper spray was used?
That's right. There was one more October 3rd out in the woods of Pacific Lumber Company, 2 young men demonstrating in the same manner with the what's called the black bear metal sleeves on. This is a tactic, by the way, in Humboldt County that's been used for many, many years and has never been met with this kind of force before. And additionally, in Congressman Riggs' office on October 16th, 4 women.
That's the one that we saw the videotape of.
That's right. And we have videos of both. And although, in fact, most of the videotape that you see across the nation right now is of Congressman Riggs' office, It is even more sadistic what you see in Scotia, California, in the headquarters of Pacific Lumber Company, the one in which Spring was an attendee. Keep in mind that these videotapes roll for a good 45 to 50 minutes each. The clips that the nation is seeing are pretty much indicative of the entire scenario. In other words, the chemical agent was applied. They waited, and then they reapplied the chemical agent in a variety of forms. And when that didn't work, the law enforcement stood around over the circle of sobbing, convulsing women and said, well, listen, if you unlock, we'll give you some first aid. So the thing about chemical spray, pepper spray, is that it is designed to get worse. It doesn't get better. It gets worse. And so the pattern that we see here is very, very chilling, and the tapes that we have of they're going to be followed by more. Let's put it that way. There are additional videotapes out there, which we intend to acquire very shortly.
How'd you get these?
I got these videotapes by representing these individuals in criminal cases because in addition to the treatment they were recorded by the County Sheriff's Department, Sheriff Dennis Lewis, Chief Arnie Millsap of the Eureka Police Department, these folks have criminal charges for trespassing against them. And both of the groups in the headquarters and then the group in Congressman Riggs' office spent 5 days in jail, except for the juveniles, before even getting an arraignment. In this county, if you do a symbolic protest, you are likely to serve about zero time if you are found guilty. And so there's a penal aspect to this, which is very, very disquieting.
Mark Harris, when we spoke last night, you were talking about how Pacific Lumber, the police, and an insurance company were involved in the videotaping of the spraying.
That's right. The full story is still unraveling, but it's unraveling very quickly. At this stage, the FBI advised me day before yesterday that the third video camera, the women in the Pacific Lumber headquarters who watched and were treated this way, observed another video camera. Besides the deputy, there was a man in plain clothes that was videoing them. And it turns out that that individual was from the insurance company. He was essentially a risk manager or assurance adjuster. And what this tells us is that the county sheriff, before doing this, actually contacted their insurance carrier and said, hey, can you help us dictate the way that we use force on these protesters? And the insurance company presumably came over and said, hang on, don't start the show. We're going to bring our own camcorder. So it's a very chilling thing because what we're talking about is a corporation dictating how a public law enforcement agency might or might not act.
Mark Harris, the attorney representing the nine demonstrators who are protesting Pacific Lumber's plans to log old growth forests. I don't want to end this segment before talking exactly about what the protests are about and the stage that everything is at. Spring, how did you get involved with these protests, and can you explain the extent of the redwood forests and the extent to which the company wants to log them?
Yes, definitely. I've grown up here in Humboldt County and been hiking the redwoods with my father for many years. Headwaters Forest is a little-known thing to even people who live in this community at times because it's privately owned, and so people don't get to see this amazing place. But it's the last unprotected ancient stand of redwoods in the world, and it's right here in Humboldt. The community here is totally outraged by Charles Hurwitz coming in from an outside position and liquidating the ecosystems here, as well as buying out Pacific Lumber from a family-owned status and liquidating the pension fund and not caring about safety practices for workers.
And the U.S. government has offered to buy this land?
Yes, well, the myth that I seek to quell is about the size of Headwaters Forest. There are six groves in Headwaters Forest, and two of the groves are sought to be protected in this deal. But especially the community in this area, which understands the issues in a detailed way, know that this deal that Dianne Feinstein and Garamendi and Hurwitz are coming together on does
Dianne
not...
Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California.
Yes, the senator from California here, does not care about the ecosystems or the jobs of workers displaced. We are calling for not one more ancient tree, and also that this deal must not be passed unless the ecosystems and the people in this community are accounted for. In this so-called Headwaters deal, more trees will fall, more old-growth ancient trees will fall in this area than would be allowed right now under existing environmental legislation.
Well, Spring Lundberg, those screams that you and others uttered over these last 3 months as the sheriff's deputies applied pepper spray to your eyes have now been heard around the country and perhaps the world. And we've also heard, and I've been surprised at this, about the Headwaters protest as well. So sounds like it's educating people, and we'll certainly continue to cover the civil rights lawsuit that you have brought. What are you asking for in the suit?
I just hope for an injunction, a stop to this brutality, to see incidents happen after my incident and my friends being in suffering positions this way is just too heart-wrenching.
If people want to get in touch with the Headwaters Defense Group, where can they call?
A good number is the Mendocino Environmental Center here in California, and that number is 707-468-1660.
That's 707-468-1660. Spring Lundberg, Park Harris, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Spring Lundberg, 17 years old, high school student, pepper sprayed by police, and Mark Harris, attorney representing the protesters who were attacked by the police. I want to thank you very much for joining us from Humboldt County. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Affirmative action proponents appear to be gaining momentum in their bid to defeat a California-style ban on policies that mandate racial and gender opportunities in the nation's fourth largest city. Tomorrow, voters in Houston will be the first to consider an affirmative action ban since passage of California's Prop 209, that's Proposition 209, a year ago. The Houston ballot initiative, known as Son of 209, is just one of some 43 ballot initiatives that voters will be voting on in 9 states across the country tomorrow. We're going to talk about some of those initiatives, but begin with the Houston initiative. We're joined by Dave Walden, chief of staff for Houston Mayor Bob Lanier, and Galen Nelson, director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center, a resource and information center for activists and organizers working on initiatives and referenda around the country. Dave Walden, tell us about this initiative in Houston.
Well, it was primarily put together by one fellow named Ed Bloom, who is a stockbroker and ironically a municipal bond salesman for a large company called Payne Weber. And he went out to California, met with Ward Connerly out there, saw what they did with 209, and decided to export that little baby back here. Joined up with a group of Bail Anglo contractors called the Houston Contractors Association, some local radical Republicans, and even a few members of the minority community who were kind of outsiders. And meanwhile, got 20,000 signatures on a petition and got it on the ballot for this November. It's run a pretty active campaign. Once they started getting a lot of money, of course, they went on TV, as we have, and they've been popping us hard every day. They started out on the high road, quoting John F. Kennedy, and, you know, over the last couple of weeks anyway, slipped into the gutter. I think the campaign's pretty much dead even. We are picking up a momentum. We're about 5 points better than we were, according to a recent Chronicle poll, than we were a month ago. but we're still behind. We still got to make a big push if we're going to win. And if we do win, it'll be a very, very close victory.
Who's putting the money in against affirmative action for this initiative?
It's white male contractors, construction contractors primarily, who just feel that the 80% of the business that they get from the city isn't enough. They apparently want it all. Ward Connerly's group in California has put in about 20,000 last time a report was filed, and I suspect that they've put in a lot more since then.
Wall Street Journal talked about last week a number of outside Texas multinational corporations that were funding this.
They're funding our side.
The large corporations, not the companies in Houston?
Well, they're large corporations who have headquarters in Houston or a large presence in Houston.
Like?
Nations Bank, for example, has been just great. Exxon, Texaco especially, Conoco, Shell Oil.
And why do they want to keep affirmative action?
I think that they realize that the diversity and competition that's produced through our particular affirmative action program is good for the city. It's good for business in the city. It's good to have all elements and all segments of the community involved in the city's business since we all pay taxes. And there's a feeling of we've got a great thing going in Houston in terms of racial harmony. And they did not want to sit idly by and let this group from California team up with these local folks and disrupt that.
It's interesting that the piece in the New York Times yesterday on Houston voting on a repeal of affirmative action focused on this whole question of words,
right,
on Ed Bloom's version of the anti-affirmative action bill and how your mayor, who you work for, his chief of staff, Mayor Bob Lanier, changed those words.
Well, we didn't really change their words. They made a mistake on their petition. They wanted to use the exact language keyed to Houston, of course, that was used in California. But at the very beginning, the headline on their petition, it said, a petition to end preferential treatment, parentheses, affirmative action. And we spied that like a hawk and said, okay, if that's going to be the headline on your petition, that's going to be what's on the ballot. And so we, as we're allowed by state law, wrote the ballot language to say, you know, shall the city charter of Houston be amended to end affirmative action for women and minorities in city contracts and employment? And Bloom didn't like that. He spent about 3 weeks fighting it, went to federal court, lost in his attempt to get a temporary restraining order. And so that's exactly what people are voting on tomorrow.
How about the mayor's race? Mayor Bob Lanier is not running again because of term limits. Lee Brown is running. He was the former New York City police commissioner. He was police commissioner in Atlanta as well. Has he taken a strong stand on this?
Oh, yeah. I think all the leading candidates for mayor except one have said they will vote no. They all make comments about it, about improving the program or trying to make it better just to cover, you know, their basis, but every leading candidate has said that they recommend a no vote. Brown's been especially hard on that point. He says the civil rights initiative, the so-called civil rights initiative, is not civil and it's not right. By the way, he's the Houston police chief here for 8 years, too.
That's right, now running for mayor.
Right.
Well, Dave Walden, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Chief of Staff for Houston Mayor Bob Lanier. As I said, Galen Nelson is also with us to look at Houston, but to go beyond and look at the 43 initiatives that are going to be voted on around the country tomorrow. Galen Nelson, we have just covered the Houston initiative, but anything you want to add, and do you see other initiatives like this cropping up around the country? It's interesting, Ed Bloom is involved, the Houston businessman who successfully sued last year to redraw congressional districts drawn to help elect minority members to Congress.
Right. I think Dave explained the situation pretty well in Houston. This is simply part of a larger strategy by right-wing groups around the country to divide communities and drive up conservative voter turnout in targeted electoral races. In fact, right-wing groups have invested a lot of money in propping up anti-affirmative action groups, both in Washington and in the states. Clint Bolick with the Conservative Institute for Justice helped Ward Connerly launch the American Civil Rights Institute, which is, of course, the group that grew out of the Prop 209 anti-affirmative action effort in California. So there's a lot of Washington involvement as well in this issue. I think that we're going to expect to see some more anti-affirmative action measures in Washington, Florida, and perhaps Colorado in 1998.
How do they get on ballots? Does it differ state to state?
The process differs widely. Some states have fairly stringent signature gathering requirements. In others, it's quite easy to get an initiative on the ballot. Generally, the requirements range from 5% of the voting public in the last gubernatorial election to 10 or 12%, depending on the state and whether or not the initiative is an attempt to amend the state constitution or simply to amend statute. There are also a number of other time limit requirements and notary public verification requirements in the various states.
Let's talk about some of the other initiatives. For example, what's happening in Washington State?
Well, in Washington State, there are about seven or eight initiatives and referenda that will appear on the ballot tomorrow. A couple of them are getting a lot of national attention. Initiative 677 is the first attempt proactively to pass gay civil rights legislation. Of course, the right wing is saying that it's a special rights bill, which is absolutely ridiculous. There's specific language in the initiative that there's broad exemptions for religious groups, small employers, and it specifically prohibits preferences or quotas. So we're hoping that that initiative passes. It seems to be doing fairly well. In the polls, a number of high-ranking elected officials have endorsed the measure, and they seem to be moving along with quite a bit of momentum. We also have an effort in Washington, a gun control effort that's drawn a lot of attention from the NRA. It's an effort to mandate trigger locks on all handguns. It's a serious problem in Washington State. A lot of children and infants are killed with handguns every year, needless accidents, and the trigger locks proponents say would do much to prevent those accidents. There's also a training course and test involved in this initiative, and the NRA is spending millions in misleading ads to try and defeat that measure.
What about in Oregon?
In Oregon, there's an effort to repeal the physician-assisted suicide measure that passed last year, and that effort is largely being attacked or funded. The effort to repeal is being funded by Oregon Right to Life and by the Catholic Church. Those are at least the two primary funders. And that effort also, in the polls right now, seems to be holding up. It looks like Oregon voters will reject this repeal effort.
And in New York, Constitutional Convention?
Yes. Every 20 years, the New York State Constitution requires that a question be placed before the voters asking them whether or not they want to convene a constitutional convention. And the last convention was held in 1967. It was a specially scheduled convention. And there were several amendments that were proposed. They were all rejected. The convention question was soundly defeated in 1977. So here we are at 1997. Most progressive groups, with few exceptions, are opposing this convention simply because, for a couple of reasons. One, the cost of the convention is at least, it's exorbitant, at least $50 million or so. The delegate selection process is very unfair. In the past conventions, the delegation has been largely comprised of elected officials, political insiders, white males. It's an exclusive convention. And frankly, you know, we can do a lot better things with our tax dollars than waste money on an undemocratic convention in New York State.
We're talking to Galen Nelson, who is with the Ballot Initiative Center, looking at ballot initiatives around the country. It's called the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. Who supports the center?
The center was launched in 1996 by a diverse group of progressive environmental, civil rights, economic justice, and other organizations, including the Environmental Working Group, People for the American Way, Americans for the Environment in the Western States Center. The purpose, as you said, is multifaceted. It's geared towards both organizers who are involved in initiatives and referenda, but also individuals, activists around the country who want to get involved in initiatives and referenda. So many people are discouraged and frankly disgusted by their elected officials but still want to get involved in issues. And this is a great way for people who want to defend affirmative action, fight for greater environmental protection, fight to protect our public schools against vouchers, to get involved in an initiative campaign, an issue campaign. And what we're trying to do, one of the things we're trying to do with our website, which is at www.ballot.org, is connect activists around the country to progressive initiative campaigns.
Gayla Nelson, what about bilingual education up for a vote in Orange, California?
I think we're going to see that that effort's actually going to roll out in other states as well. We've seen some variations of that effort, English only, in Florida and Alaska. Petitions are circulating there on that issue for 1998 and perhaps in a few other states. Once again, this is another divisive issue. The right loves to launch these types of issues that force progressive groups to expend human and financial resources where they normally wouldn't. And this is part of an overall strategy that spearheaded in some ways by Grover Norquist, the conservative leader of Americans for Tax Reform. He's one of the chief architects of this right-wing initiative strategy that in some ways melds electoral politics with initiative politics. It's an effort to launch right-wing initiatives, divisive wedge-issue initiatives, whether that's anti-labor initiatives, anti-gay initiatives, anti-choice initiatives, in states with hotly contested statewide races. And David Broder, a columnist for The Washington Post, eloquently explained this strategy in a column a few weeks ago in which he showed the connection between the anti-labor initiative that's circulating in California right now for 1998 that would prohibit union dues checkoff, and similar legislation introduced a few weeks later by Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. So we see this connection here between, at some time, state-level legislation, federal legislation, and statewide ballot initiatives. And this effort in California, this anti-labor effort, is being funded by J. Patrick Rooney, who's a huge Republican donor, a medical savings account and voucher advocate. And at the same time that Rooney is helping to fund this anti-labor initiative in California, he's throwing money through the Evergreen Freedom Foundation in Seattle, which is a conservative think tank, into an effort to attack the Washington Education Association, the teachers union in Washington State.
Gayla Nelson.
So,
yes, go ahead.
Just to finish up, so this kind of strategy, combining electoral politics with initiative politics, is, again, clearly a way to drive up conservative voter turnout in electoral races and also to give conservative candidates a heightened profile. This anti-labor initiative is clearly Pete Wilson's baby, and the parental consent, that's the anti-choice initiative that's circulating, actually it's under review by the Attorney General in California right now, is kind of seen as Dan Lundgren's baby. He wants to run with that initiative when he runs for governor in 98.
Before we go, I just wanted to ask you about something other than ballot initiatives, and that's one of the groups you work with, People for the American Way, coming out with their statement accusing the Christian Coalition of lying to the voters of Virginia. The charge came in the wake of a detailed study of the Christian Coalition's voter guides for tomorrow's Virginia elections.
Yeah, People for the American Way obtained the voter guides, and once again, it's People for the American Way Action Fund, as reported in the past. The Christian Coalition is lying to the voters of Virginia, as it has in other states, with their distorted and misleading voter guides. The guides distort the issues and mislead voters about what questions the candidates have been asked, about what answers the candidates have or not supplied. The guides mix and match the issues upon which they report so as to omit issue positions of Democratic candidates that might earn favor among the Christian Coalition's constituency. And of course, the guides distort those answers that the candidates supply. And just a few examples, looking at the guide this year, in the races for governor in Virginia, lieutenant governor and attorney general reported candidates' positions on, quote, abortion on demand, which is, of course, the inflammatory phrase used by anti-choice groups to cast disfavor on the pro-choice position, did not appear anywhere in the Christian Coalition's voter guide questionnaire. So it's absolutely misleading that they use that language in the voter guide itself. In the races for governor and attorney general, reported candidates' positions on, quote, raising income taxes, also never appeared in the questionnaire itself. So once again, it's just incredibly misleading. Another example, the Christian Coalition did not print information about partial birth abortion as it did in the governor's race, presumably because the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor takes the Christian Coalition's position. So again, where it's good for them, they'll omit a position that's favorable to their constituency for a Democratic candidate.
These kind of charges have been raised before, but the Christian Coalition continues to put out these kind of voter guides. Is there any serious effort for them to lose their tax-exempt status?
Well, one of the things that we did at this press conference we held in Richmond, where we released the report and criticized the Christian Coalition and urged churches not to distribute the guides, primarily because it endangers the tax status of the churches, is to call on the IRS and the FEC to step up their efforts to go after the Christian Coalition because of these gross violations, both ethical and legal, of the law.
Gayla Nelson, thanks very much for being with us, director of the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center. You can go online and see about all of the ballot initiatives around the country. That's www.ballot.org, www.ballot.org. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Next, we're going to turn to the Virginia governor's race, talk more extensively about it, as well as the New Jersey governor's race. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, President Clinton was doing something, I was going to say a little bit different this weekend, but unfortunately it's not so different. And that is he and Vice President Al Gore were at an exclusive event for donors who gave $50,000 a head to spend the weekend with the president and the vice president. In the New York Times, it says today, Bill Clinton may think he's underappreciated, but he's not undervalued. More than 50 people shelled out $50,000 each to spend the weekend schmoozing with him and the vice president at one of the nation's premier luxury oceanfront resorts in Amelia Island, Florida. The money, a total of more than $2.5 million, will help bail out the Democratic National Committee. The party is reeling from a debt of $18 million, although the $3 million it has on hand from Clinton's prolific fundraising reduces it to about $15 million. Still, the amount is an intolerable debt for the Democrats who are trying to recapture the House in 98, and Clinton doesn't want to pass the debt on to the man he sees as his heir, and that is Al Gore. The event was believed to be the first of its kind in which a sitting president and vice president lent themselves out not just for a half-hour coffee or an hour at lunch, but for a full weekend, including two nights in the fancy Ritz-Carlton Hotel. The president then left there and went on to Virginia, where he stumped for State Senator James McGreevy, who is running in a surprisingly strong challenge against Governor Christine Todd Whitman. This is one of two gubernatorial races in the country. He also went on to stump for Ruth Messenger, the Democratic candidate for mayor in New York, against the incumbent Rudolph Giuliani, a Republican. Another gubernatorial race that's happening in the country is Virginia, where two-term Republican Lieutenant Governor James Gilmore is taking on Democrat Donald Beyer. And we're joined right now by two poll watchers. We're joined by two journalists, Bob Henley, a contributing editor at the New Jersey Monthly, writes for the New York Times and the Village Voice, the New York Observer, about New Jersey matters. We're also joined by Ron Nixon, who's a reporter with the Roanoke Times in Virginia. Our listeners may remember Ron as a reporter with Southern Exposure, which was based in North Carolina, and he's moved on to the Roanoke Times. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks for having us.
Well, why don't we begin with where President Clinton was yesterday, and that was New Jersey. James McGreevy versus Christine Todd Whitman. Bob Henley, what are the issues at hand, and how close is it?
In the final few days, it looks like Whitman may be getting a little bit of an edge. They have 9 points in the Eagleton Star Ledger poll, but there's certainly tremendous surprise at the fact that there is not consensus, certainly in the polls. There's a broad range. The issues that McGreevy has been raising have been the fact that New Jersey has the unfortunate distinction of being number one in property taxes and car insurance, and that the state, like much of the Northeast, is still not feeling this tremendous economic rebound that's alleged to have occurred throughout the country. Particularly affected have been middle-class folks who actually have, as I'm sure your listeners are well aware of, actually had a decline in their buying power over the last few years.
A big issue raised in New Jersey has been how Christine Todd Whitman cut taxes. People around the country may remember that 30% tax cut. It was very significant also for the presidential race as something for Bob Dole to do is raise the issue of cutting taxes because Christine Todd Whitman had won in such a big way before.
Well, I guess that in the case of the tax cuts, the problem being that at the last in the last year of her budget cycle, in her first term, she had to turn to what some people considered a fiscal gimmick by refinancing the pension, thus having to narrow the amount that she had to put in this year. So instead of some $600 million, she got to put in $67 million. That gave her a little leeway. She'll argue that actually it makes the pension plan more stable and reduces borrowing costs, and her opponents will argue the opposite. However, everybody was on pins and needles when the stock market went haywire last week, and of course that is where all this borrowing has, that was the purpose of the borrowing, so that basically the state could play the market.
What about Virginia, Ron Nixon? Tell us about this race between the two-term Republican Lieutenant Governor James Gilmore and the Democrat Donald Beyer.
Well, let me do a correction real quickly here. It's a two-term Lieutenant Governor Don Beyer, who's a Democrat, that's running against a former Attorney General, the Republican Jim Gilmore. The big issue in this race so far is the personal property tax on cars and trucks. Mr. Gilmore, the Republican candidate for governor, has introduced a plan that will slowly phase out the personal property tax on cars and trucks over a five-year period. The year that he's out of office is the year that it will be fully implemented. And what this does is basically eliminate, for localities, it eliminates a large source of revenue, and that's been a big point for the localities in lobbying against this particular measure. However, it's been pretty popular with voters, in that it's given Mr. Gilmore between an 8 and 12-point lead in the poll so far here on election, on the eve of Election Day. I believe he's leading by 9 points. Mr. Beyer is from Northern Virginia, which is the richest area in the state, and a lot of political analysts believe that this plan was to offset Mr. Beyer's popularity in Northern Virginia. That's where he lives, and he owns a Volvo dealership there as well. And it's been pretty effective because the people up there pay a pretty high personal property tax on their cars and trucks. And so he's in a Mr. Byers in a dead heat with Mr. Gilmore in an area that he was supposed to take with no problem. That's been the big issue in the election, and to the exclusion of a lot of other issues. Education and the environment has come up, but this personal property tax or the elimination of this personal property tax on cars and trucks has been the big issue here. And the funny thing is that you're talking about New Jersey. That's one of the things that the Democrats have used to say that the state does not need to have a personal property tax gimmick like that, because we don't want to end up like New Jersey.
Well, how galvanized are the voters of Virginia?
Well, it's been pretty vanilla in terms of the election. Other than this personal property tax, the two candidates aren't that much different. Mr. Beyer, the Democrat, also has a plan to offset the personal property tax by giving families of different incomes, if you make up to $75,000, you can deduct $250 from your state income tax, and if you make up to $40,000, you can deduct $150 from your state income tax at the end of the year to offset the personal property tax. They both have talked a lot about education. Mr. Beyer, the Democrat, has brought up the issue of the environment and the fact that as a Attorney General, Mr. Gilmore, the Republican, sued the federal government to stop them from enforcing, you know, certain environmental regulations in the state. Of course, there was a big Listeria outbreak in the Chesapeake Bay, and that became a pretty big issue. But overall, the two candidates aren't that much different. And the only thing that seems to have gotten Mr. Gilmore slightly ahead is this personal property tax exemption on cars and trucks. I mean, even people who don't know the guy's name say the no car tax guy. You know, that's that's who we need to vote for. So it's become a big selling point for people.
Bob Hennelly, in addition to covering the Virginia, the New Jersey governor's race, you've also been looking at the only congressional race tomorrow in the country. And
that would be the Democrat Vitliano against the Republican Fosella, the city councilman.
And Vitliano, this is in Staten Island,
right,
taking they're fighting over Susan Molinari's seat, who became a CBS Saturday morning news anchor.
To abysmal critical reviews, apparently.
So tell us about Staten Island. These people are not very well known outside of their areas, perhaps not even in their areas,
right,
but it has become what they're saying is a bellwether for Republican and Democratic strategists in this off-election campaign
right.
year to test out some of their strategies.
Well, actually, I think that of course, there was a family patriarchy there with Guy Molinari there for years as a borough president, and his daughter, he was a congressman, too, and then his daughter took the seat, and it was almost like female primogeniture. Then she went to the Fourth Estate, defected, and now this nasty contest opened up. I think some people think that Vosella is ahead. President Clinton did come in again this weekend to try to do everything he could to try to help get at least one additional seat, and was quite partisan. I mean, a local feed that we saw on television, he was talking about the contract on America, and we didn't get any of that fuzzy, warm feeling from the mythopoetic of the balanced bipartisan budget deal. That was gone.
In Virginia, on the whole issue of Christine Todd Whitman, how are Republicans around the country seeing her now?
New Jersey, you mean?
New Jersey.
I think the problem here is that the far right would love to see her defeated. And maybe the greatest thing that she did was to mediate the draconian excesses of her own party in Washington with Newt Gingrich. Particularly, she went to bat on the plight of legal immigrants and their SSI benefits, Social Security, and also trying to prevent them from going off the deep end. She also is pro-choice. She's pro-gay rights. She has gone to the mat internally, and she can't really use that. She can't say, use me as a bulwark against the idiot right. But in point of fact, there's a Libertarian candidate who did qualify for public funds in New Jersey, who is running against Whitman and McGreevy, and also is taking the stand of being against late-term abortions, which makes him a standout between the two. And remember, this is a state where 500,000 voters in 92 voted for Perot. New Jersey is really crucial to both parties because Clinton did improve on his margin from 92 to 96 by 100,000 votes. And then he did have Torricelli, you know, in an abysmal congressional context. They've had some bright spots here. They had Lautenberg win. They had Torricelli win. And so they're looking to New Jersey as the place that they could turn it around on the national stage. However, McGreevy has had some real problems. He apparently had his marriage come apart in the primary cycle to the point that when I made calls initially to do a review of all the candidates in the primary, it was quite a contentious primary, in the questionnaire we asked, what is your marital status? And the campaign manager said, held the phone away from his mouth and said to a colleague, what are we saying about the marriage today? And somebody yelled back, separated. So that's how kind of fluid the situation was. And I think now that's kind of hurting him because he's conceded, at least in the times and the places that he's chosen, politics over his family. And that issue of balancing work and family is the central issue from which all others spring, because people are having to trade in the 8-hour day for the 24-hour worker consciousness, with single parents working more hours than ever before and two-income households being the rule as opposed to the exception.
You know, with the nanny trial getting a lot of attention, you still wonder why, or perhaps we don't wonder why, but there isn't a national debate and just a reinvigorated focus. And it could happen in Virginia, it could happen in New Jersey, it could happen all over the country around the issue of daycare.
Women, it's funny. Women in the last few days has been raising these issues because she's getting women voters to come back to her. The initial Eagleton Star Ledger poll showed that she had kind of a gender gap. And now she's closing it a bit because of the fact that McGreevy's engaged in what's kind of like an honest, quite frankly, confessional about his desire to be a workaholic as opposed to trying to balance the two. And also, I might add, you know, women within her state, we have our entire assembly and Senate are up this year, and we've got some pretty interesting elements in the Senate. In fact, last year there was a very strong movement to pass a minor death penalty for people under 18. So that's the kind of stuff that Whitman has to deal with within her own party.
Ron Nixon, I'm going to give you the last word on Virginia. If politicians dealt with the key issues in the state, according to how you would rate key issues, what do you think should be the major issue in the Virginia governor's race?
I think certainly education would be one, and the Democratic candidate has tried to bring it up, but as it says, been drowned out by the issue of the car tax. But there's an inequality in the state education system. The poor areas like here in Southwest Virginia really pale in comparison to areas like the Tidewater with Norfolk and Hampton, Richmond and Northern Virginia. That's a really key issue. And also the issue of the environment. Our Department of Environmental Quality, the employees there have been really demoralized because they've undergone about 8 reorganizations in about a 3-year period.
On that note, Ron, we're going to have to say goodbye. Ron Nixon, reporter with the Roanoke Times in Virginia, and Bob Henley, contributing editor to the New Jersey Monthly, on the two gubernatorial races in the country, New Jersey and Virginia. We'd like to know how you feel about races in your area and perhaps ballot initiatives. You can call us and leave a message at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Leslie George is our director. Errol Maitland and Andy York are our engineers. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!